You're listening to Maine Public Radio. Tonight, we present Who Gets to Tell the Story? I'm Lucy Suchak. Sponsored by the Champlain Institute at the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, this program features a conversation between best-selling novelists Embolo Embuwe and Christina Baker Klein. While addressing questions of authorial rights and cultural appropriation, they'll share personal stories about their own experiences as novelists stepping outside the box. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. Introducing the speakers today is Lynn Bolger, Dean for Institutional Advancement at College of the Atlantic.
In March of 2017, a media explosion was detonated by a painting in the Whitney Biennial. The artist, a white American woman named Dana Schutz. The painting, Open Casket. The subject, Emmett Till, the black 14-year-old boy who was lynched by two white men in Mississippi in 1955 and posthumously became an icon of the civil rights movement. Schutz is known for such stylized depictions of historic figures. As Calvin Trillin wrote in The New Yorker, Schutz's paintings, in which abstract and figurative images combine to tell enigmatic stories, sometimes carry veiled references to what's going on in the world. Sometimes not so veiled. Men's Retreat, made in 2005, shows blindfolded members of George Bush's cabinet pursuing strange outdoor activities. Poison Man, painted the same year, is an imagined portrait of the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yushchenko, who barely survived an assassination attempt in 2004. But neither of these paintings blew the internet up. Open Casket did. Why? Shortly after the Whitney Biennial opened, Parker Bright, an activist and artist, stood directly in front of the painting in a t-shirt, on the back of which he had written, Black Death Spectacle. The image went viral. Protests grew inside and outside the Whitney, then inside and outside the art world. From Berlin, Hannah Black, a Black-identified biracial artist who hails from the UK, wrote, "It is not acceptable for a white person to transmute Black suffering into profit and entertainment." Others wrote that artistic expression and freedom of speech is paramount. Cuban-American interdisciplinary artist Coco Fusco wrote, "Censorship, not the painting, must go." For months, the argument raged on in art sites, salons, in op-ed pieces, on stages like this one. If you Google Emmett Till, Dana Schutz, in 0.75 seconds, 63,000 results will be available for your viewing and reading pleasure. But though this happened only 2 years ago, in fact, this debate is not new, nor is the controversy confined to the visual arts. A highly polarized quarrel around ownership of subject and group membership also rages in other artistic forms, which brings us to this evening's discussion. Who gets to tell the story? Please join me in welcoming Julian Zugasagotia back to the stage. Julian will talk to our very special guests, Christina Baker Klein and Embolo Embuwe, two award-winning novelists who wrangle with the questions in their work. Thank you.
I am out of my depths in the literary world, but I'm so honored to be moderating this conversation with two very, very acclaimed authors. As you know, Christina Baker Klein and Embolo Embuwe have something in common. They're both New York Times best-selling authors, and their books have been raved by the New York Times and others. But there's a major difference, and we'll go in that, insofar that Christina has already published five or six novels, And Imbolo's first novel was the one that caught the art world and the critical world by fire. And so that in of itself is an interesting point. Mm. And as we're talking about where the voices come from and what are we allowed to write about, or what are we allowed to paint, or what are the subjects that we can talk upon, I think it's important to then bring into the front that Christina was born in Cambridge, England, and was raised also in the US, that you spend a lot of time, so you're one of the local heroes that uses also Mount Desert Island both for retreat and inspiration, and that uses this incredible place for your inspiration. And on the other side, Imbolo grew up in Limbe in Cameroon before moving to the US in 1998. She holds a BS from Rutgers University and an MA from Columbia, and now she lives in New York City. So a diasporadic life, and from which you wrote your first book. So that the notion of writing with different perspectives, I think, has been something that now in the literary world has also come into focus, whether the visual arts had the impact around that piece, but some of the same things are happening in the literary world. And today you're writing your next novel, of which we would love to hear about, but from the perspective of an Aboriginal from Australia. And you've lived in Australia, so you have a bit of experience, but is that enough to claim that you can write from that perspective?
Hi, everyone. I'll start. I'm gonna say, I want to briefly tell you that I begged Imbolo to come to Maine. We both live in New York, and
I've never been to Maine before. This is my first time.
So everything.
You didn't need to beg me a
I
lot.
Didn't need, a little bit. I needed to beg a little bit. But yeah. A few years ago, I get a lot of books to blurb, mm-hmm. and I often rush through the first chapter to see what I think and then politely decline. And this book came across my desk, and I could not believe how brilliant it was. If you haven't read Behold the Dreamers yet, you're in for a treat. It is a sweeping story of a Cameroonian immigrant who comes to New York and is a driver for one of the principals of Lehman Brothers at the time of the crash. And it's just beautifully told, and she embodies many different perspectives. But then I kind of I gave her a blurb. Then I stalked her and found her at the Savannah Book Festival, and I tackled you basically after your talk and made her be my friend. So it's always nice.
Can I just say something also? Because since you're from Maine, I have to brag about Christina, okay? Because I've only written one book, and as a new writer, you know, you don't know a lot, right? You write a book, and there's so much to know about this industry, and Christina has been one of my mentors. So that is why I'm here, because she's one of my mentors, and she advises me, so I just want to, like, praise her for the wonderful work she does to help, you know, young writers like me, because she does a lot of that, and that is why I'm here today, because she also, you know, introduces me to new opportunities that I wouldn't otherwise have thought of. Of course, I would never have been to Maine otherwise.
Because like lobster.
Yes.
Her children ate
so
lobster.
So this is a big love fest, you know, yeah. So you're watching a big love fest going on stage, but we're going to talk about other things soon.
We did say that we need to manufacture some controversy between us.
Yeah.
Anyway, so to get
of which
back,
I will get caught in the middle.
So to get back to the main point, I've never lived in Australia, but I spent six weeks as a Rotary Fellow in my 20s. My family, my father, William Baker, many of you may know in the audience, is a historian, and he took the family to live in Australia for a year. I didn't get to visit, but my dad was obsessed at one point with a book called The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes that some of you may have read. And I became obsessed with it as well. And that's why I applied for this Rotary Fellowship, and I went. And then between that experience in my 20s and today, I've taught in women's prisons. I wrote a book on feminism with my mother. And I found these different pieces of my life coalescing around the idea of the convict women who were essentially sent to Australia as sex slaves. They were swept off the streets of Great Britain and ended up populating Australia. And even though their lives were horrific, many of them, eventually, when they got out of prison, these turn the place around. They ran the schools, and they were entrepreneurs, and they opened hospitals, and they just had all this agency that they would never have been able to have in England, the very stratified class-based society. So it was actually transformative in so many ways. So that was the book that I got the contract for. Mbolo and I, at this, well, she's newer but has the same experience, which is that you come up with an idea and you sell the idea. So the idea was to write that book about these convict women. But as I began researching it, and I did a lot of research and went to Australia twice and read everything I could get my hands on and interviewed people, I realized that I couldn't tell this story of these women, which, as I say, was very intense, without telling the much more terrible story of what happened to the Aboriginal people, who were essentially exterminated. There was a shoot-to-kill policy at the time that these convict women were being brought over on repurposed slave ships. The Aboriginal people were being hunted and killed. And so I knew that this was very difficult, thorny material. And I wrote my novel, it's finished, but it's coming out next year, in the third person. So I wasn't writing from the perspective of an Aboriginal person. And my character is 8 to 11 years old, which I think makes my job a little bit easier also. I'm writing about a child's experience. And the third thing is that it's a real person. This girl existed, and I'm following the story of her, the contours of her story. It was essentially a terrible version of a Pygmalion story. Her parents were killed, and the Sir John and Lady Franklin saw the children dancing and said, let's take that beautiful girl and see if we can turn her into an English lady. And so they took her to the governor's mansion and dressed her in silks and taught her how to dance and taught her French, and then abandoned her when they went back to England when she was 13 years old, and she had to exist between two worlds. So that was the story that I took on, and I'm still pretty terrified about it.
So what are the sensitivities that you have been confronted on that? Because the fact that exactly you're bringing a character that is based on real, but you have to also to be on the one side empathetic to something that you're not,
That's right.
On the other side, there is now something you were illustrating me, like sensitive readers. Tell us a little bit about what is the process of your novel, or what is the vetting that you want that novel to have in order to come to life?
I'm going to answer quickly because I really want Mbolo to talk and I don't want to hog the stage. But I'll just say quickly, some of you are writers in the audience and probably know this, but the publishing world is quite fraught around this subject. There's a lot of discussion. In my view, absolutely, deservedly so. There should be. And when now you write about someone from a culture that is not your own, you need to have what they call sensitivity readers, which means readers from that community who will vet the material to sort of raise questions about how you're handling dialogue, language. I don't do dialect, but some writers do. I know that Where the Crawdads Sing, that writer used dialect. In fact, today in Slate, there's a big piece about that novel, which is like the number one novel in America right now, written by a white woman, and it's all about to the writer, the troubling aspects of her own appropriation. It wasn't until I started reading all this material today, I read about 8 articles, that I got really terrified. But anyway, I have a professor of Aboriginal history who himself is descended from the Trugawani tribe, and who is reading the book, and I have an Australian historian who's written 15 books about this subject, and I have a number of other people reading it. But I'm doing that, and it all started for me with my novel Orphan Train, when Donna Loring, who is a Wabanaki elder, was my first reader for my Native American character, and then I brought in some more as well. Yeah. So,
but I want to, and first of all, Mbolo, you're so great mentioning that, again, this is your first novel. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're writing your first novel, you're not already thinking about the literary world in which you're now propelled, and about sensitive readers or you, all of the. So from which voice were you writing your first novel, and how did this, were you aware of where it was going or where it was going to take you?
Right. So I never imagined being a writer. Mm-hmm. I never thought much about writing, but when I opened my computer to start writing many years ago, I wanted to write stories about people like myself. I never imagined writing anything besides stories about Africans and people living in Africa and dealing with sociopolitical issues in Africa. But I started writing that story, and I couldn't really continue it because it just was not working. And then one day I got an inspiration to write the story, which Christina mentioned, about an African immigrant from Cameroon who gets a job for a Lehman Brothers executive. So I wanted to tell the story of these two families, the family of the African immigrant and the family of the Lehman Brothers executives, and how both of their lives were affected by the financial crisis. So the struggle with such a book is that I know a lot about one side, right? Yeah. I'm an African immigrant, I used to live in Harlem, I could write about those people in my sleep. Mm-hmm. Now, what do I know about rich white people living in the Upper East Side? Nothing, you know, so almost nothing. And so, which is where the issue comes from, like who gets to tell the story, because it is about empathy for me. Mm-hmm. It is hard to write about other people because we tend to be more empathetic towards people like ourselves. So when I was writing this book in the early drafts, I showered a lot of empathy on the Africans. Mm-hmm. Because I understood their struggles. They were like me, you know, I know what it's like to leave home, I know what it's like to be poor, I know what it's like to be a foreigner. And when I sent this book out to the publishing industry, you know, it was rejected over and over, because people could tell that I cared more about African people than I care about these rich white people. And so...
And most probably the editors of the people reviewing it were on the other camp.
Right, they're like, you don't like us. So that was my struggle. And I didn't know this back then, right? Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, of course I can write about anybody. But when we talk about who gets to tell the story, for me, it was because, you know, people are more likely to tell their own stories with empathy. Not that you cannot, you know, of course, write empathetically about other people, but my early drafts of the rich white people was very, very stereotypical. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. The rich woman, she just went to the spa and had Botox and whatever. And the rich man, you know, he just, you know, hung out and played golf or whatever, some kind of thing. There wasn't much depth to them because I did not know them. I did not think that their struggles were as valid as mine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it took me many years of writing and rewriting and recognizing that I was very judgmental,
yes,
towards these people. Mm-hmm. And so when I look back at this journey, I think that made me into a better writer, because I was able to learn that lesson very early on. Mm-hmm. That I had to bring in the same level of empathy for every character.
How did you do it?
Yeah.
I
how are you getting that feedback also?
So I looked at myself in the mirror, you mm-hmm. know, and I recognized my own shortcomings. I recognized that I don't like certain people. I look down on them. I think, you know, I live in New York City, you know, we don't exactly love Wall Street people so much there. Mm-hmm. And so there's this, you know, when you hang around certain kind of people and they're negative about certain people, then you kind of use that. I had to let go of that and see this Wall Street executive as a human being, as a husband and a father and somebody who also has dreams. But that didn't take a day, right? Mm-hmm. This is after lots of rejections. I mean, like, my book was rejected by every agent in the country. And so I
am... But that rejection came with some comments, or that gave you feedback on saying these characters are less developed or... So you had some feedback.
Yes, very few of them. I mean, a lot of them just say, thank you, I don't. But some of them take mm-hmm. the time to say, it is very obvious that you don't show as much, you know, empathy towards these other people mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. they're different from you. And my response was, what do you expect? You know, what mm-hmm. do you expect? Of course I should care more about people like myself. But that obviously was the wrong way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear about people talking about, like, don't tell my story, I should tell it, I think it's because we are concerned and somewhat about, you know, if you were to tell my story, like, would you really care about it the way I would care about it? Like, if you were to tell the story of an African immigrant, you know, like, would you really know? Would you really show that kindness? Because, like I said, it's for myself, and I've noticed with other people, that it is just so much easier to care about people who you share a lot in common with.
Right.
And that is a human tendency, but as a writer, you have to push past that. You know, it's very hard. It's really hard because now people praise, oh, Imbolo, you're so good to the, you know, to all your characters. You're so kind to everybody. I'm like, you think that was easy? Like, that was, I didn't wake up and say, I'm going to be kind to a rich Wall Street guy. You know, I didn't wake up thinking that. I had to push, you know, past my instinct to think less of them.
Was there a key to it for you of getting under the skin of these people?
Yes, it was a moment, you know, when I was struggling with one of the characters. This character, her name is Cindy Edwards, and she's the wife of the Wall Street executive, and she's not an easy character. And something clicked, like, what happened to her as a child? You know, like, where was she born? You know, like, who is her mother? What was her childhood like? And I said, and then I woke up one day and I saw her childhood so clearly. Like, it was one of those, I don't know whether you get that as a writer, but you wake up one day and it was like, oh, like, you, everything is so clear, you have this clarity. And when I started seeing her, like I said, I still wouldn't want to go out to coffee with her. It's not like I like her like that. But I see her, you know, I see her and I recognize the fact that she's just a human being, you know, pushing, mm-hmm. you know, pushing hard against the world. But I also, to your point, Julian, I also struggled about whether a story like the financial crisis, the fall of Lehman Brothers, whether I had the right to tell that story.
Yes.
Because I felt like that was a very important moment in American history. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I'd read one book about the financial crisis, God, Dave Eggers, A Hologram for the King, and I loved that book. And I wanted to read so many books about the financial crisis because I lost my job, you know, during the financial crisis. But I couldn't, and I said, I'm going to write a novel centered around the fall of Lehman Brothers. But there was still a sense of, like, who do you think you are? You're not Jonathan Franzen. You shouldn't be writing about it. This is, like, a very big American moment that you should, you know, somebody else should write about. But I push against that. Like, I am an American also. You know, I have a right to tell an American story also. I mean, even though this is an American story and a, you know, New York story, an African story, but part of me also felt like people were going to say, you know, like, this is a big moment for you to write about, because my character actually works at Lehman Brothers, and I write about, you know, the day Lehman Brothers collapse, which I did a lot of research on. But maybe I had to go through the phase where I gave myself permission that I can tell any story as long as I have empathy.
I think that is a good segue to some of the, you have a quote from an author, and that I'd love you to read, but I think already, how many of you here are authors or have written a book? Okay, we have a lot of people who have suffered through that process then. Because what you just said, I think, is what reverberates more in my mind. It's saying, as an author, the hours, the endless hours negotiating with yourself about creating characters, about creating fiction, you have to have such a deep passion about the story you want to tell. And that is the motor for that. So if you read those comments in a moment, what I want to ask you also is, you cannot wait till someone else write the book that you wanted to write. And if you're experience, I thought, and I got it wrong from our brief interaction yesterday, I thought you had lived longer, which even those things, when you mentioned it was 6 weeks, I understand now that your father was the one who lived there longer. But even those subtle things people are looking into today. But regardless of the time you spend there, it is your story because you deemed that it was a story worth telling, and you're investing all of your heart and soul into that somehow.
Yeah. I mean, so I would say first that passion, you have to be passionate about your story, but you don't
necessarily develop the story until you're writing the story. In other words, you don't develop the passion until you're actually in it. So there's this push-me-pull-you process of believing in yourself enough to get to the point where your passion propels you forward, which is very hard. And that's one of the conundrums of writing and being a writer. Mm-hmm. And so several things that Imbolo said that I just want to hit home are, number one, resilience, my God. Her resilience to submit to every agent in America and get rejected, and then take the little scrap that she got from several people and stand back and divorce her ego from the process and say, there is something here. I believe in my project, and yet I also am willing to listen to what this is telling me. And now she's this huge celebrated writer. I mean, but a lot of people stop at that point. Right. A lot of people stop and get discouraged. Totally. And then the second thing is what you said about, what this question is about, the claiming permission to tell the story. We're coming at it from different ends. I'm the white person. Mm-hmm. my permission feels much, giving yourself permission to tell a big story is like, yay, the world celebrates that. Do I have permission to talk about an Aboriginal girl? I don't know that I do. Do I think it's important to tell it? I absolutely do. I don't think I can write this book with the kind of integrity that I want it to have without telling that story, because it's a part of the whole story. And so for me, there are we were talking earlier in the green room about, I think you maybe are farther on the spectrum than I am about feeling that anybody should write anything. I have mixed feelings. Mm. I am not sure that I should write a story from an African perspective in the first person that is the whole book. I don't think that I'm, there are lots of other people who can do that better, who know that world.
Right.
As a part of my book that is 80 pages out of 360 pages, and again, written in the third person, I feel that I can give this minor character voice and perspective in a way that adds depth to the story, and not only that, but is a very important part of the bigger story. So I felt I had to, but I'm not sure it's a good idea.
Right.
I'm not sure that it is.
Yeah. Completely agree with that, because I feel as if sometimes people expect writers to be able to do everything or say everything. And I'll give an example. I was speaking in Pittsburgh, I think 2 years ago, I was speaking in Pittsburgh. And during the question and answer, a gentleman stands up and says, "So, Imbolo, I recently read in the New York Times, there was an article written by a black transgender woman. And she was talking about her experience of being black and transgender and living in New York City. So can you talk to us about what it's like to be black and transgender?" So I don't know the first thing about what it means to be transgender, you know. So I cannot write that story. Like, it's just not my place. Maybe he thought that because I am black, I can also know what it's like to be black and transgender. But it's very different, you know. So I am very mindful of the fact that, you know, that I, to your point, you know, you just don't say things that you don't know, you know. And that is the position which I find myself, because unlike Christina, who is very experienced and has been doing this for a very long time, this is my first book, and I find myself in a position where I'm being asked to say things that I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather stick to, you know, to what is true, what
or
I know.
Authentic.
Unauthentic, yes.
I think the authenticity part, and again, I might be more on the Coco Fusco side of the spectrum, is I'm against anything that would be censorship.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would be against anyone saying what you can write or not write.
Mm.
Now, I think what we have, and maybe what you were also explaining, is like, I think we're coming to an age in a lot of self-awareness of boundaries, of where... And that is makes what an authentic. I think what you described of the process in which you went through to rewrite some characters is so enlightening, because definitely it has to come from a place in which you as an author are the comfortable and make it, you're writing, whether it's a first person or third person, but you are embodying that. And I think that is what you said. It's you're opening to a greater empathy. Mm-hmm. So it is great that today we're respectful and that also we're allowing other voices, because before also was a system of the power of, of the publications system and everything that would allow only certain stories to be told. Mm-hmm. But it is true too that today authors have more agency in telling a wider thing, but we're looking for the authenticity of the voice. I think her novel comes across, when it hits your desk, I understand, something's very special because it's that authentic.
Right. And it's funny because I had the opposite experience from Imbolo. I, with Mathina, this character, this girl, I had such empathy for her and I felt so protective of her story that it wasn't... it wasn't that I couldn't get it. It wasn't that I didn't feel it, but my editor said, I think you're being careful with her in a way that you're not with your white characters. And maybe she's not as nasty in some ways. Do you know what I mean? I mean, so it's a weird thing to sort of take in that I am sort of protective of this character. And I think that's another issue that is really true and real and valid, which is that I don't know if white writers who have grown up in the bubble of their own invisible privilege really do understand what it is not to have it. Right. And I think this is very important.
Right.
And in publishing, it's publishing is going through a very interesting moment. I used to work as a manuscript editor, and one of the last manuscripts I got a few years ago was a white writer guy from the perspective of an African-American person. And I was just like, oh, God. Of course, it didn't get published. I am not surprised. Right. And I said to him, like, really? because publishers don't necessarily want to publish a first-person narration by a white male about a black, from a black woman's perspective. Say what you will about empathy.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
You know.
Right. I mean, I think that the problem and the reason why there's so much pushback, especially against whites writing as blacks, is because for so long blacks were not allowed to tell their own stories.
Right. That's right.
You know, for so long. I mean, if you look at books about Africans from early on, it was white people telling some crazy old stories about African people. I mean, so now, and that is why there's, so much excitement about Africans writing right now, because, it's been happening for many years, not just now, but we are telling our own stories. And it makes a tremendous difference when people tell their own stories as opposed to somebody. I remember somebody said to me, about Behold the Dreamers, he said, oh, I'm so glad you actually from the town in the book, you're not some Peace Corps person who went on Peace Corps and came back and thought they knew that town. But it's because, there is something to be said about everybody being given a chance, And there's still a lot of that still needs to be happened. You know, more people need to be given opportunities to tell their stories. So even if, a white man could tell a great story about a disabled black woman, it's like, why don't we help that disabled black woman to find a way to tell her own story in some form?
Yes.
So that, that is also the bigger issue, the politics in publishing, and who the gatekeepers are, because it is a very, very, very wide industry as far as the gatekeepers. But there's been a tremendous amount of change. I mean, and we've seen, we've seen a lot more diversity now.
Yeah, with the writers, right. Some of you may know the novel Pachinko, which is a wonderful novel by Min-Jin Lee. So I was talking with Min-Jin Lee a few weeks ago about the response to that novel, which I found masterful, I loved it, and it was about Korean people in Japan and the discrimination against them. And she was saying that in the Asian community, she got a lot of pushback about it, actually. And so that in her own world, there was also a question of appropriation, even though she herself is Asian and Japanese, but had very complicated responses to it.
So I think it's kind of happening in all kinds of ways.
You're listening to a special presentation of Who Gets to Tell the Story on Maine Public Radio. Mbola Wembuwe and Christina Baker Klein will now answer questions from the audience.
There's one question here, and we have two mics floating around, apparently.
Hello. Two things you haven't mentioned, which I'd like you to respond to. One is Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is probably the most important novel in American history, a white woman telling story of Africans. And the other is the role of the imagination. Mm-hmm. No one said that. Now, you seem very concerned about how things are going to be received, whether you're allowed to do this. But it always seemed to me that an artist, through their imagination, could justify something that was a great gift to the world, despite other objections.
So I'll say that, yes, I hear you about the imagination, but I think that part of what we're dealing with is that our stories, at least what my novel and Christina's work in progress, also needed a lot of research. And so we had to also do, imagination can take you so far, but you also need, when you're writing a novel that is based on, on events that happened, that you have to be very careful that you keep the historical details in place. But my novel needed a lot of imagination because I'm writing about a chauffeur who works for Lehman Brothers Executive, a world in which I knew nothing. And so I had to imagine the life of a chauffeur. I had to imagine the life of a Wall Street executive. I don't know anybody who was a Wall Street executive. A lot of this just came out of thinking about what it's like to be a Wall Street executive and what it's like to struggle knowing that Lehman Brothers, where this guy works, is likely going to collapse. I had to imagine what went on behind the scenes at Lehman Brothers and also ways in which this family struggled, because on the surface, they seem to be living the American dream. But I had to really think about the fact that, people tend to have struggles that you cannot see, and imagine, really legitimate struggles for them, ones that I might not really have myself, but, find them to be credible enough to write about. And I'm not sure what your first question was.
About Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yeah. Oh, but I wish I didn't read, so I'll let you talk about that one.
a book like Uncle Tom's Cabin and Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer and books written in the 19th century that have an element of race, or Faulkner, are important to read and also being revisited in all kinds of ways that are looking at assumptions that white writers have made about the people they write about, including, as I said earlier, dialect and representation, the way people are described physically, for example. And I think that it's legitimate both to understand and think about what's useful, what's important in those books, and to have a conversation about how the world has changed. Speaking of how the world has changed, I think we're having this conversation, not to be whatever, political, but in the context of Trump and his grotesque representation of people who don't look like him. And I think part of the reason the publishing world is sort of thinking about this in such an overt way, and that you hear us trying to wrestle with some of these questions, is that we're confronted with a president of the United States who sees people who don't look like him as less than. Mm. And that the fact that we're at this stage in 2019 is, I think, staggering to most of us. But writers are all wrestling with how to write in the age of Trump. And for me, I think, even though my novel takes place in 1840 to 1868, I think my work has gotten increasingly political in my own mind, not on the page necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I'm aware, as I'm writing about these children who were imprisoned, kept from their mothers, put in what they called orphanages, but they were really prisons, not having committed a crime, I'm thinking of
today's context.
Immigrant children in cages today. With Orphan Train, as I talked about that novel, I started saying things
in my speeches because I got increasingly frustrated. I was in a lot of red states, and I'm sorry, I don't presume you're all Democrats in this room, but I will just say that there was a lot of talk about how back in the day we treated the Irish so badly. And I had to say, you know, every immigrant group that's come to this country has undergone a hazing process. Mm-hmm. And it's as true today of Muslims and Mexicans as it was of the Irish and the Italians at the turn of the century. And it's not different. And also that the history of our country is not the history of the poor and the dispossessed. And the more books I write, the more interested I am, you might say obsessed I am, with the history of the poor and the dispossessed, and that's what this book is about. And so as far as the role of the imagination goes, it's absolutely primary. And so much of, I think, for me, the first draft, I don't know about you, Mbolo, is just pushing all of these questions aside and doing it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I wouldn't write a word. I have to just get rid of all of the worry about appropriation, the worry, the doubt about my right to tell a story. Do I have any right to tell an Australian story? No. Mm-hmm. So the only right I have, and this is a very slim thread, is that like the characters in Orphan Train, I am actually English, Irish, and Scottish. So those people who ended up on the convict ships, those are my people. I feel I have a right to do that. But and then I've branched beyond it. So.
Branching beyond, and I think that is also, and I alluded yesterday in a few of the remarks, is that I think there is a point and that the greatest common denominator, why I think both of you can write a story about another human being, is because you have, and you are, a human being. And right. And I think if you push far, when you're looking at a Lehman Brothers executive you've never encountered or you never know, but there are some elements, and maybe it's good for the story, maybe it's not good for the story, but there are elements in which we are all confronted with the same level of humanity. Mm-hmm. We are strive to succeed, our strive to have our children grow in a better world than we encounter, our strive. And those are human emotions that I think is your raw material for every day. Mm-hmm. And that's why, again, from my perspective, it's like, that is what you're shaping. Mm-hmm. Now, from which perspective and to what ends is then all of the others.
But even, and I don't mean to, even the most well-meaning and well-received for a time productions, like for example, Green Book, that won the Academy Award this year, and The Help, Catherine Stockett, a novel that also became a movie, both of those were very well received at first. But they were, you know, won an Academy Award and what, and even the black actors who were in The Help spent some time at the very beginning sort of defending the story. Mm-hmm. That was a process. And then, and you could speak to that, I'm sure, there was a huge tsunami of a backlash to both of those. Mm-hmm. To both of those. And in my view, it was a learning experience for a lot of white people, but it was also a really important thing to be hearing what felt wrong, what is wrong and was wrong about the representation.
Well, I don't think that any writer, you know, sits and says, I'm going to write a book that is going about other people to offend, you know? Like, you know, you have an inspiration, at least in my case, you have an inspiration and you want to tell this story because you believe it matters. And everything else, you know, like the permission or whether, you know, is sensitive enough, that comes later. Because for me, when I have an idea, I just want to tell the story. And then, you know, thankfully we have editors, you know, who say, you know, like, this needs help. This needs a lot of work. Like, for example, in Behold the Dreamers, I had a minor character who is a gay man. And I remember my editor, who was a gay man also, like, he sent me back his edits, and he goes, something the gay character said, and he goes, a gay man would never say this. I'm like, thank you. I'm glad you said it before anybody else said that to me. Like, this is not something a gay man would say. But, you know, you have that. But I think that sometimes we're a little too harsh on people who, you know, yes, they might do it the wrong way, but I think the intention also matters. You know, the intention that, you know, somebody wanted to tell a story. And yes, obviously, you know, there's money involved and people want to make money sometimes, but there are many, many people who just had an intention to share a story that they believe had not been told, and they wanted to tell it. And it just so happened in my case that I had the opposite situation, because the kind of people that I depicted in Behold the Dreamers who are not like me, i.e. wealthy, Upper East Side, Wall Street, Manhattanites, they love how I portrayed them. Oh my God, Imbolo, you got us right. This is exactly how we talk. This is how so, and they all want to know how I did it. You know, do you know anybody like us? They're very surprised that an African immigrant, you know, got into their heads like that. But it is, again, because I had to really believe that I could understand another fellow human, to your point that, I mean, you hear it all the time today, it's such a cliche, we're all the same, but really, we're all the same. I mean, when you write a novel, you see that. Like, there's no difference between any of us. Like, writing a novel just made that so clear to me, because you realize that humans, you know, are driven by the same kind of things, and they have fears and dreams, and they worry. And I remember at one point, I asked my editor, who is a wonderful, wonderful editor, my former editor, he's also a novelist, David Ibeshov, he wrote The Danish Girl, and so I said to him, I said, you know, because there's just very different characters, you know, the way an Upper East Side socialite speaks is different from the way, you know, an African immigrant in the Harlem speaks. And I said, do you think I have the differences in the way they speak? Do you think it's clear enough? I don't want them to sound alike. And he said, Imbolo, we're all saying the same things, you know. And I realized, wow, you know, that yes, you know, it could be different, but writing my novel was such a journey for me. It was such a journey, and it's a big lesson in seeing myself, you know, that it wasn't even so much. That is why I was also able to get past the rejections, because I saw it as not so much about this novel, but also about me and coming to terms with how I see the world and to recognize my own shortcomings in how I write about other people.
You said earlier also that it was a mirror, but also you have to put it outside. A mirror is something that is out.
I believe that what has been imagined and created is a sufficient answer to the basic question we explore here. To excise Queequeg, Joe Polis, Jim, and Dilsey from Moby Dick, The Maine Woods, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and The Sound and the Fury, is to wound those novels and reduce America.
Thank you.
Here, further down the aisle, or do we have a question there in the back? Sorry. Yes.
Okay. I'm not too articulate, but I'd like to say that the story, you are storytellers, and I believe you should not have to be afraid to tell the story if it's an honest effort to experience something else that will change our perspectives a little bit or a lot. And it's not a question, I just am afraid of saying, don't be afraid that you might offend somebody. That starts the conversation and also develops us as individuals.
Thank you.
Can I say something to that, though?
Yes. Yeah.
So to me, it's not about being afraid to offend anyone at all. What I think is useful about this conversation and about the thinking that we do on the subject is that it forces us to think 4 times, 5 times carefully about what the skin is that we're getting underneath, what the story really is, not to be glib about it, to take it very seriously. And I think there are a lot of, I told you, I got a lot of books across my desk, and a lot of them don't get under the skin, and they're not successful for that reason. And I think that it's useful, actually, to think of the weight of responsibility of trying to respectfully and lovingly and carefully and generously and truthfully show a culture that's not your own.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, that is why Christina is a very successful writer, because, you know, it is not just to tell a story, it is about telling it honestly and completely. And that takes a lot of work. I mean, it is an ugly process for me. I don't know about writing a novel. It is ugly, ugly. somebody said to me, would you let your child be a writer? I'm like, I hope not. a novelist, because it is, so I'm just about finished writing my second novel. But to really go into everything, you know, and because a novel is made up of 1 million little pieces that all have to come together.
Yeah.
You know, and if one or two pieces don't come together, you will tell. You can tell. The readers can tell. So it is not about being afraid. It's that you feel like you have been given this incredible, you know, responsibility, and you have to, you know, be accountable and tell it and do justice to it. And that is what happened with me with Behold the Dreamers and with you also with your books, is that if I did not, like the very kind lady said, if I did not go through that process and put myself through that process, Behold the Dreamers would not be what it is. And I wasn't driven by fear. I didn't have any readers to worry about. I had no audience. I'd never published anything. So it wasn't like I was worrying about, like, what will my fans like it? No, I had none of that. But it was important to me that I do an excellent job. Because this story, you know, was not so much my story. Many people had told me their stories and struggles of being immigrants, of being working class Americans, of struggling during the financial crisis. And I had so many different inspirations and ideas, and I had to put it together and write this story. And that, you know, there's some stories in there were not mine. They were other people's story, and I was mindful that I had to tell the story right. Like, you know, like, this is not my story, but I've been given this honor to tell the story, and I cannot just, you know, play with it. And that is what we feel, you know, is the responsibility. And that whether or not the right, because even if readers don't love your book, which happens sometimes, you can spend 1 million years and write a great book and nobody likes it, you know. But at least you know that you gave everything and that you were true to the story, the authenticity.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. There was another question here. Oh, there and then here.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for joining us here in Maine. I'm curious, the four speakers I've heard so far at this particular institute have talked about empathy. If you'd be willing to share how your development of empathy as a function of your writing has impacted your interactions with people in your daily lives, I'd like to hear about that.
Mm-hmm. I'll let you go first.
No, you were the one.
So yes, I think that I no longer just see people like that. I know that there's a lot more behind, more than what I see. Because what you learn, and we hear every day, everybody has a story. Everybody has a story. You may not like the story, you may not care to hear it, but they have a story. So the thing that I'm very mindful is that even when I meet people who are not nice to me, and even now that I'm a writer, I'm still a black woman, I'm still an immigrant, I still have an accent, so I still get my share of people who don't treat me very nicely. But I push myself to recognize that even they have a story, because that is what helped me to write the book that I did. And how do you get there? How do you get to that place of knowing people's stories? There's only one way for me, questions. You ask people questions. You ask them, you know. Maybe some people don't want to tell you, but a simple question, like, how are you, or where are you from? Even though, where are you from? I don't love that question so much, because I get But just a simple question about somebody, and that makes a connection. And I think that is what is happening today in this country, is that we're just not curious enough about each other. You know, there's just not enough curiosity. And I am a much more curious person right now about my fellow humans, because I recognize that, you know, even if I don't like you, you have a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure for me which came first. I think I was just a sensitive child. I've always sort of existed in the gray area in my own head. I find it hard to write op-eds. I get asked to write op-eds sometimes, and I'm like, I'm not sure how I feel. I feel that I'm in the, I can understand that perspective and this perspective. And I have fairly strong feelings about Trump, as you know, but other than that. But I think that I sort of brought that to it. I was just thinking, though, as you were talking about looking behind
looking at people in a different way. For me, we're teaching in a women's prison. I taught at the only all-female women's prison in New Jersey. It's called the Clinton Correctional Facility, and it has 700 inmates. 300 of them are in maximum security, and I taught in supermax, the lifers, the people who were never leaving. And it changed my life teaching in this place because it actually was almost like the tool that I brought was almost too strong. You know, there's that quote, Mariel Rukeyser said, if one woman were to tell the truth about her life, the world would split open. And I was having these women write memoir and poetry and memoir about their lives, and no one had asked a lot of them for their stories. And so they just, once they started, they couldn't stop telling their stories. And the depth and breadth of those life experiences and the difference between what I experienced the first day when I came in and what I recognized on the last day, and I'll just say this because it was such a shocking thing. Here I am teaching these women who are never getting out of prison, and I, in between my last two sessions, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I was starting chemotherapy right away, and I couldn't, and I'm fine now, but I couldn't go back. I said, I have to go back and say goodbye to them. I can't just not go say anything. So I went back, and I just said, you know, this happened to me. I hope to be back, but I can't do it now. And they burst into tears and said, oh, well, we have it bad, but that's way worse. Like, they felt so sorry for me. That's when I got really worried about my about living. But they were so filled with empathy, with care, with love. And again, this is why I wrote this novel about these Australian women, these convicts, because I felt I really understood something I'd never understood before. Mm.
Well, I think those are great words to end. Again, artists are expanding our universe. Both of you are representatives both of a literature that is sensitive to our times, a literature that allows us to understand better the present, even if for you it's going back to 1800s and historical, but because they're grounded in experiences, transformative. And thank you for sharing what you share about your work with women in prisons and how also you opened to them and how they regave you back that confidence, that also trust. And I think in today's world, authenticity, empathy, and trust are things that I think will propel us forward. As difficult as the time might feel or seem to some of us today, also we have to recognize that a panel like this is a tribute to the thing that we're moving still forward. So again, what an honor to be with each of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Who Gets to Tell the Story on Maine Public Radio. Today you heard from Mbolo Mbuwe and Christina Baker Klein discussing their experiences as best-selling novelists. Music in this hour comes from the Kronos Quartet. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this special, and it was edited by me, Lucy Suchak. Thanks for joining us.